Hello, friends. Welcome back to another episode of Theology in the Raw. My name is Preston Sprinkle. I'm the host for today's show. And on today's show, my guest is Tish Harrison Warren. Tish Warren is a priest in the Anglican Church in North America. She's the author of an incredible book, Liturgy of the Ordinary, Sacred Practices in Everyday Life, which, as we talked about in the podcast, it won the Christianity Today's Book Award for 2018, which is a huge accomplishment. I mean, there's a lot of books that are up for, you know, winning that award, and Tish's book won it in 2018. She also is the author of the forthcoming book. Depending on when I release this, it might actually have already be out. It's called Prayer in the Night for Those Who Work, Watch, or Weep by InterVarsity Press. Both of the books are by IVP. So Tish is, she's a fascinating individual, super thoughtful, super down to earth. And I just, every time she speaks, she just oozes wisdom and humor. That's what I love. She's a very well-rounded person, as you'll see. In this conversation, our talk is, it's kind of, it's centered on her two books, but her two books have such interesting themes that we'll get into. And so we go on some tangents and we kind of unpack some things related to those themes. We end the podcast. I really encourage you to listen all the way to the end, or if you're on YouTube, you know, watch all the way to the end, because towards the end, we talk about theodicy, the problem of evil. And her second book, Prayer in the Night, deals with that, and it flows out of her own personal journey. And it's I think the last 10 or 15 minutes of our conversation was probably the most raw and real and meaningful. I mean, the whole thing was meaningful, but I mean, I we kind of started opening up lots of cans of worms. So I hope you enjoy this episode. I'm sure you will. Also, if you want to support the show, you can go to patreon.com/theologyintheraw. This is a listener or watcher, viewer supported show. And you can find more info in the show notes. It's patreon.com/theologyintheraw. And you can support the show for as little as $5 a month to get access to lots of premium content in return, and also get access to the Theology in the Raw community, where we have lots of discussions and Q&As and giveaways and lots of fun stuff. So head over there if you want to support the show. Otherwise, I hope you enjoy this conversation with Tish Harrison Warren. Tish, welcome back to Theology in the Raw. Prayer in the Night is your new book. Depending on when this podcast release, it might be available for pre-sale or for actual sale. It comes out in the, January 26th, you said? Or
yeah, that's right. Cool. January 26th is the release date. So you can pre-order it now. I think today is what, the 5th?
Today's the 5th, yeah.
12th day of Christmas. So it's, which is why the Christmas tree is still up. We keep it up till the 7th. But, nice. So that's exactly 3 weeks. Cool. It comes out in exactly 3 weeks from today. So you can pre-order it or order it depending on whether or not it's when people listen to this podcast.
Your previous book, your first book, Liturgy of the Ordinary, Sacred Practices in Everyday Life, won the Christianity Today 2018 Book of the Year Award. That's a big deal. Did you expect that? I mean, of course you're gonna say no, but I would I don't know. I'll let you answer the question. Did you expect to win the Book of the Year Award? That's incredible.
So Liturgy of the Ordinary has done far more than I could have ever expected. But I mean, it got far more accolades than I was expecting, far more readers. It is my first book. Should I say it was my first book, or it is? I mean, I have a second book now, but it's my first book. And so, you know, I was a relatively unknown author. I was still new. I mean, I freelanced and wrote for various things, but no one expected. I mean, the publisher, me, my husband, my mother, no one expected it to do what it did. And so, yeah, so it, No is the answer. I didn't expect that. And,
I wanted you to say, yeah, of course. I mean, if I didn't get book of the year, I would have like, what am I doing?
Yeah. So no, with your first book, everything's so new. Mm-hmm. It's like you go through a honeymoon period as a writer. It's just this exciting new, everything's new. And, then just like a honeymoon period in a marriage, you go like that wears off and you have to figure out how to do this, you know, when the novelty of it wears off. I know it makes it actually hard to do a second book, because my temptation is to go out on top. Before. I just talked to Esau Macaulay, is a good friend of mine, and his book just won Christianity the Book of the Year, this year.
Did
his
it?
Book Reading World.
Oh, and congrats, Esau. I had him on the podcast right when he released the book.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so we're like really, really close friends. He's one of my best friends. We talk on the phone a lot. And I was like, welcome to the club, man. Like your very first book won lots of awards and this sold well. Like it's not easy. And he's like, I know. He's like, you used to complain to me about this and I didn't understand. And now that I'm here, I'm like, man, I just like what? Like you just, your second book, you know, there's like no way. It's a sophomore album now. So yeah.
What was it about your book what's the itch that it scratched from your perspective as you look back on that? Like, why did it?
People have asked that too. I think it's, you know, astoundingly good writing. I'm just kidding.
Heavenly prose.
I mean, I don't know. Like, I do hope that I'm a good writer and the other books will also resonate with people. I don't know. I mean, I really don't. But I think, man, I don't know. Why do these things happen? Yeah. Like, why do some books land? I think there's a few. There was some cultural stuff happening. I think, well, it's widely applicable. Like everybody. It's not a book about that applies to one demographic. Like. Everyone wakes up, everyone gets stuck in traffic, everyone goes to sleep at night and eats leftovers. And so it was something that a really wide audience, I mean, really, and I've heard from like urban 20-year-old hipsters and an Irish Amish colony, like that
really?
They all, like everyone has read it, like people, and now it's in six languages. And so think, there's something like human about it. I also think, you know, it was funny because it came out in December 2016, so 4 years ago now. And it was right after Donald Trump got elected. And so I had the sense of like, well, no one's going to buy my book. Like nobody cares now. It feels like half the world feels like the world is ending and 54% of America feels like the world is ending, and the other percent that voted for Trump are mad at those 54% or, you know, feel like the world is just beginning. So no, this little book is going to get lost and all that. But I actually think that when things feel like they're going so off the rails globally, like the sense of like, what does faithfulness look like? Uh-huh. In the molecular level, which is what the book is about. Like, how do I actually meet Jesus, not just in these sort of like the global catastrophes that are playing out, but in my actual day became newly important to people, like people needing to sort of know how to seek God in their daily life. And I also just think books in general, this is not just my book, and I hope I'm not tooting my own horn here, but I think I can say as authors, the best books are books that show, not just tell. So my book is, since the book's come out, a lot of people have asked me to speak on it, and I do that, but it's actually sort of a terrible book to speak on in the sense that many Christian books are an argument. And the book is making an argument. But it would be difficult to say what argument my book is making. There's certainly themes, like that daily life is a place to encounter God. The theme of formation is huge. The theme of liturgy is huge, obviously. But there's not a linear argument. It's an exploration of one day of my life. Like, the book is about one, begins in the morning and ends with me drifting to sleep. It's about one day. And so I think something about showing people, exploring ideas instead of, and I'm not against linear argument at all, but I do think people are drawn to the difference between a podcast and a book is that there is something about a book that can be much more sort of poetic, symbolic, a long exploration together that then empowers people to continue doing that in their daily life, which would be different than a talk, right? Or a podcast, or maybe not a podcast, but I don't know. So I'm saying like a linear presentation. So that's part of it. I mean, the other thing that I can't explain is that the idea of liturgy has become more important to folks. I think my book was part of that, but it was also, it's much broader than that. Mm-hmm. And so it's much broader than my book. And so, like, I've told this story before, but when I pitched the book in 2014, because between the time you write the book and the book comes out, there's over a year. So it's a long period. And when I did that, it was with, it didn't have the exact same title, but it was similar. It had the word liturgy in it. And they said, we like the book idea, but you can't use the word liturgy in your title because evangelicals won't buy it. And I said, okay. So like a year later, when it was time to turn in the book, I pitched them like 14 different title ideas, all without the word liturgy in it. And then they came back to me with a title that was almost identical to my original title. And I was like, but you said I couldn't have that. And they were like, well, we talked to the marketing team and they're like younger and hipper than the editorial team. And they said that evangelicals like liturgy now. And so I was like, well, that works well for me. And so there was something that happened in that time of evangelicals getting more interested in the broader lowercase c Catholic tradition, the long history and tradition of the church, that I think is still continuing, but that my book could be part of. So I don't know. I mean, this is complete speculation on my part. If somebody has like the formula that made the book a success, please let me know so that I can do it again.
Sometime I have to. Yeah. I mean, I've been writing for almost 10 years now, and that's the one thing that whenever I'm around somebody in the industry who's behind the scenes, you know, a publicist, a publisher, a agent, whatever, I'm like, what makes a book take off? And everybody says the same thing. Some books you can kind of predict, but most of the time the book you think is going to take off doesn't. The ones that you don't think are going to go anywhere absolutely explode. The Shack was one that I think barely made it in past the publishers or whatever. Like, why did The Shack take off? And people are still wondering maybe why. The Eldritch, Wild at Heart, I heard was, and if you don't know, I mean, people criticize the book, and I'm not like for or against it, but it took off. But they said that was word of mouth. Like, it sold hardly anything the first year, I heard, but just everybody that bought it told two people about it. And it just slowly, and then it became, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of copies it sold. But
yeah,
there's no formula, really. I mean, of course, there's so Esau's book, that one's a little, it's like, oh, of course. I mean, here, right smack dab in the midst of all these racial tensions and conversations, and to get a real sane, wise voice like Esau to speak.
His book hit at the exact right moment.
So that one's, you know, a little more, I don't say predictable, but some of, you know, I love, I was going to say the title is so BA, Liturgy of the Ordinary. I mean, that's such a great title. Why do you think it is that younger people are now, we'll say in the last 5 or 6 years, becoming more attracted to lowercase c Catholic traditions and liturgy and so on? Do you have any thoughts on that? Like, why there's this kind of resurgence of the ancient?
Yeah, I really do. I think there's good things that are motivating this and slightly less good. So I don't want to make it like this is an adulterated revival in the church or something, but I will start with the good. Like, I think, some of it is that I think for a long time in evangelicalism, I'm going to speak to sort of white evangelicalism specifically, like your typical kind of stereotypical evangelical church. But, there's been a lot of it that, is a little parasitical is too much of a negative word, but some less negative word than parasitical that's reliant on a host culture. So it's gotten a lot of its forms from things like CEO, like a business, right? Mm-hmm. Like a mega church is like generally like an entertainment, model, or with a CEO pastor, right? So corporate models or models of like a TED Talk with a band, kind of, and some. I mean, I guess there's been some sort of like response to that, which is more kind of whatever. I was like on the edges of kind of the emergent church movement and that whole thing, but that still can just be like another subculture model. Like, yeah, we're doing like an independent coffee house kind of vibe. I think that works if people have like a general sense that church is like sort of worth their time, or that it's a place you might go to like figure out how to live better, or, have, you know, 3 steps to a happy marriage, or like whatever it is. But as Christian cult, as like the last sad gasp of Christian culture kind of fades as that's dying, I think young people are either leaving the faith altogether, because it's not giving them, they don't, it's not, there's no cash value for it in their life. They don't need it. You no longer like need to go to church because that's what all your neighbors do, and that's the whatever American thing to do. And so, those who stay, I think, no, we almost intuitively know that we need deep, deep roots, that we're just not going to be able to weather the storm of of modernity and post-modernity. And I don't even know if post-modernity actually exists. I think it's just modernity continued. So modernity with...
I'm going to come back to that, but keep going.
But we're not going to kind of be able to weather the questions and doubts and life in contemporary America, and the difficulties of that and the marginalization of that without being rooted in something very lasting and real, and that is, not a fad, and that can support the weight of our souls, and that is a bigger room that we can walk in rather than something that we sort of only have to kind of gin up in ourselves. And so I think there is a sense of going back to the Christian tradition, both to root ourselves theologically, but also that these forms, there's an understanding of that they shape us. I think that's part of it. I think there's a draw to being formed by something older and more enduring than ourselves or our own assumptions or our own culture, because liturgy by nature is cross-cultural. It's transcend. It's cross-cultural. It comes from a different culture. I mean, we read things from the 3rd century and John Chrysostom's prayer in our liturgy, like that is from a different culture. And then I also think there's beauty. I think we're drawn to beauty. I think that we're drawn to the aesthetics of worship in a way that that there was a time where people thought, well, let's make worship look like just like the mall or just like Starbucks. And people, that works, unless people are like, well, then why the hell don't I just spend my Sunday morning on Starbucks or the mall, right? And so I think there's something about sacredness and weirdness and ancientness that sort of draws younger folks. Mm-hmm. But I think it's more than just aesthetics. I really think that as things, as people suffer, as you face suffering, the kind of evangelical, like, rah, rah, go Jesus, like, figure out, like, come have deeper and deeper, like, emotional experiences of faith, whatever that looks like, just starts to, it doesn't work anymore. And you have to go to things that can sustain your soul over a lifetime of faith. And the things that can sustain your soul over a lifetime of faith are things that have sustained other people's soul for their lifetimes of faith for thousands of years, right? So I think it's a desire for rootedness.
And like,
I don't know. What do you think of that?
No, like what you know. It was a genuine question too. Sometimes
I think it's all good. I could get into sort of, I think there can be a little bit of a dark side to this. And I can get into that too, but that's the good, that's the positive draw, I think.
Yeah. Well, I like what you said at the end, just that almost like, I get nervous using categories. I don't want to broad brush churches, but for lack of better terms, the kind of seeker movement. Well, you said the rah rah, you know, but like that real kind of high energy and less on the maybe depth and rootedness and meaningfulness like that. And this is an inexact analogy, but like eating Snicker bars for food, you know, it's like, man, it gives you energy. It's super enjoyable. Life's amazing. But after, you know, a few days, couple of weeks, you know, when you start, some health problems start creeping in and, you know, late afternoon crashes and you start seeing this tastes way better than a salad, but there's something about a salad that's going to sustain me more through the storms. And in a similar way, these more thinner, brands of church, the church experience, again, that can work for a time, but after a while, it's not. When you lose a child to cancer, when you know your wife leaves you, you find out that your spouse is gay after 30 years of marriage. You know, like people go through, or if you're one of the 20% of women in particular who have been sexually abused and have never had a context to work through it, like an awesome worship set isn't gonna heal that trauma, you know. Well, I don't want to diminish the Spirit's work in whatever form, but yeah, I do. Anyway, I just want to agree. I do think that there is a stronger movement, especially among a younger generation, for more meaningfulness, and they have hard questions that they're asking, and I think they want more authentic, humble, wise guidance. I know my kids are my kids, and people say, well, you can't compare your kids to other people. My kids, they can't even go to like a youth group. They've tried so many and they're like, I don't like, can we talk about something deep and meaningful? And I've got hard questions and I don't need a cool youth pastor to be my friend. I need a leader to disciple me, you know, in really hard questions, you know, that my dad can't answer, you know? And like, so they're just like, they see right through it. They have such a hard time with that. But I think that's I don't know. I think that's actually more common than people realize. Well, is that part of your journey? Because you weren't raised Anglican, right? What was your
denominational
background?
So I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church in Texas, which is its whole own thing. There's like Texas Baptist is a deal. That's a culture. I was not in like a, it's difficult for me to explain my upbringing to people who weren't in it because it, my parents were not at all fundamentalists. Like they drank alcohol. I was around cussing. At one point in college, my mom told me I need to have more boyfriends and drink more. So like it was not, and she was sort of kidding, but I was a very serious about my faith kid. And she like was genuinely worried about me. I think that it was, I was taking Christianity like a little too far. I didn't kiss dating goodbye ever. That wouldn't have been something that my parents would have been very confused. If a boy asked them to court me, they'd be like, what the hell is wrong with that kid? my dad would just be like, just ask her to the movies if you want. I don't know what you're asking me, son. But that said, it was like a conservative Baptist church, right? Like God and country and that sort of thing. So it was kind of around that. But I grew up in Austin also. Okay. So I was around that, but I was also have memories of like walking on the drag and buying poetry from hippies and, my friends smoking pot and that. So, I had a sort of conversion experience at a young, pretty 10 or 11. And, it was very significant to me. And, I had a really visceral, profound experience of God's presence. This would be too long of a story to tell, but my faith was very real to me as a kid. And, but I was in this sort of like, my school was pretty conservative Christian school, but my peer group and life was sort of, I was really into theater. So I was in the movie Dazed and Confused, when I was, okay, I've never said that on a podcast.
In Dazed and Confused?
This is actually the first time I've ever said this publicly. That's funny, but
my respect for you just like double. All right.
Yeah, I was in it. I was a freshman girl in that movie. So
wait, like an extra? So or did you have any speaking parts? Or
no, I didn't have a speaking part. I was an extra in the scene where the last day of school when everyone runs out and they have paddles. They're coming after the lead characters with paddles. Or maybe it's the first day of school. I don't remember. And I was in bell bottoms and ran out of the school like 100 times. I mean, like it was a small cast because it was a low budget movie. And so they just filmed the same groups from all different angles. So it took like 9 hours to do the scene. We just did it over and over again, And so they'd call cut. And then, you know, like everybody would smoke everything during the break. Right. And so, but I didn't, like I was in conflicting cross currents of culture. Okay. Like there was, right.
And it makes total sense. Yeah. So, you're in a progressive environment. You yourself aren't fundamentalist, but you're in also a conservative church context. And you had a family that's very broadly, sanely evangelical, for lack of better terms. When did the Anglican thing happen?
Yeah, much later. So I actually went in college, started going to a PCA church and, kind of became reformed. Like I didn't have that. I didn't know what that would have in high school. I wouldn't have known what that term meant, but was exposed to sort of like doctrines of grace and, mostly grace. That I grew up I knew Jesus, but I had no concept of grace and of myself as a sinner. I was a really good kid, like an obedient kid. So the notion of myself as a sinner was more theoretical than real. And sort of through college and making, like, screwing up and seeing my own selfishness in a lot of ways, I ended up going to this Presbyterian church in the PCA, and was in the PCA for like 12 years, something like that. And then really it was after seminary, sort of accidentally, I ended up becoming Anglican. We didn't mean to. We were back in Austin where I was from, just for kind of like a gap year between seminary and when my husband was applying for PhD programs. And so we just knew we had to find a church quickly because we were there a short time. And so we couldn't find a PCA church for various reasons. And so there was this little Episcopal church that was just like a very small, sweet, evangelical Episcopal church. And we started going, saying, like, this is going to be a summer fling for us. We're only going, we were there for a year, but we were like, this is, we're not staying, we're not going to become Anglican, or this is just like a new experience. Well, anyway, I write about this in the book, but every week that I went, I wept. I just cried through the service because it was so needed. It was like water to actually what I told my husband in the car every week was like, it's like chamomile tea. Like, it just felt like so comforting and nourishing. And like, if you've ever had like strep throat and drank like chamomile tea, it's just this like needed thing. And I felt like, we had been, when we lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts before this, right between Harvard and MIT. Wow. We went to a brilliant church, but the Presbyterian church can be so, so heady and doctrinal. I tend to be heady and doctrinal. My husband has a PhD now, and we were in seminary. So we were just soaking up like the very, very best ideas of the faith. We were soaking up doctrine. We were reading all the time. We were learning Greek and Hebrew. And all of that was great, especially because both of us were from a little bit of like anti-intellectual Christian backgrounds.
Yeah.
And so being like unsatisfied with that, it was like very healing to find this like theological ferment happening. But it got, after years of that and being married to each other, we first of all had a faith that kind of only used our brains, and was really disconnected from our bodies and that sort of thing. But also I just had no notion of formation. And so we were like, knew our stuff. Like, we were like theologically informed and fighting like cats and dogs with each other in our marriage. Like, it wasn't like resulting in sanctification, humility, kindness. Like, that was not happening. And so the rootedness that I talked about, and the use of my body, and being just like, I was really exhausted at the time. And so being able to sort of just throw myself in the liturgy and not have to get to a certain like cognitive place or of depth of belief or emotional place was incredibly liberating for me. So really the formation coming in my life was so transformative.
Wow.
And the liturgy itself, we just completely fell in love with. It was, we just totally fell in love. So at the end of that, we actually moved to Nashville for my husband to go to Vanderbilt, and we tried to go back and we just couldn't do it. We couldn't do it. So we ended up just Anglican, and then eventually got ordained, and I'm an Anglican priest, and so is he. So,
oh, he is too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wait,
our
kids
are
same church?
They're double preachers' kids, so pray for them. Like,
and two, very intellectual. Well, that's pretty rare. Yeah, so you guys are...
I mean, he's way more intellectual than me, but yeah.
I want to transition to Prayer in the Night, because we started 35 minutes ago. I was trying to jump... My goal was to start with your newest book and work our way backwards. That's gone, but let's jump
in
now.
It was really important to me that, you know, I feel like IVP wants me to prioritize telling you I was in Dazed and Confused when I was 14 over my newest book that I want people to read.
I am still, I mean, more impressed with your cameo in Dazed and Confused than your writing. No, just kidding. Did you actually meet Matthew McConaughey?
No, I never met him.
Him. Well, back then he wasn't.
I've been around him.
What's that?
I've been around him because I'm from Austin and he's from Austin.
Oh, okay.
So I've been in restaurants where he was like next to me, and his kid went to school with my nephew. So sat by him in school assemblies and stuff, but I haven't met Matthew McConaughey.
I don't follow Hollywood stars too much. Too much. My kids would say probably not at all, but he's one that I've listened to a few podcasts that he's been on, and maybe just the characters that he usually portrays. He seems like a different kind of Hollywood. He just seems a little more real. I don't know if that's true or not, but I don't know.
He's
I'm a fan.
Very Texan.
Very Texan.
Super Texan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The accent's
very
real.
Austin.
Prayer in the Night. Yes, for those who work or watch or weep, give us the a couple minute overview of what this book is all about, and then I'm sure that'll take us several different directions.
Yeah. So this book, my second book, came out of a few experiences in my life coming together. One was the year 2017 was just difficult for me. We moved across the country from Austin to Pittsburgh in January. And a week later, my father passed away suddenly back in Texas. And then I found out the day after his funeral. So I had a plane ticket booked to go back home for his birthday. And I used it for his funeral. And I spoke at his funeral, and the day after I found out I was pregnant, and which was joyful for us. We had wanted a third child, and 3 weeks later I miscarried. And then surprisingly, like a complete fluke, was pregnant again. And, that was a long, hard, pregnancy, and I had to be on bed rest for part of it. And then that July, second trimester, we lost our son. So it was like 6 months of just a really rough year. I've said this several times, but there's a whole sort of genre of like Christian, response to truly catastrophic tragedy. In some sense, I mean, this was very painful, but it was also this is kind of a normal pain in the sense that a lot of us lose parents. All of us, if we live long enough, we'll lose our parents. A lot of us move. A lot of us have miscarriages. It's 1 in 4 pregnancies and a miscarriage. So This is not a book about this really hard thing I went through. It's not really actually about that at all. It's about when I went through that, a few things happened. Number one, I sort of felt like I didn't know how to pray anymore. I felt like there was so many questions, and I was so tired, and I didn't know how to trust God. And questions of sort of the way I say it in the book is if we cannot trust God to keep bad things from happening to us, which we cannot, then how do we trust God at all? And I didn't know the answer. I started the book not knowing how to answer that question. And that was a theological question, but it was a very practical question too, how do I continue in this faith in Jesus when I don't know how to, when I can't be reliant on my own energy or my own ardent faith, which was because I was full of doubt. And I didn't know how to talk to God. In the middle of that, also, night became really hard for me. I could sort of keep going during the day, but I would have anxiety at night, or the stillness of night was really overwhelming to me. And so I would fill it up with Netflix, a lot of Netflix, a lot of Twitter, a lot of reading political articles. This was 2017, so a lot was happening in our world at the time. And I would just, night became this sort of difficult, fearful thing for me. For me, that like all of that sort of hinged on the notion of vulnerability. Like, why does God allow us to remain vulnerable, to be vulnerable? Night is a really vulnerable time. I really through a counselor, came back to the practice of Compline, which is an Anglican office of prayer at night. It's the final prayers of the night. A prayer office is like a prayer service that we do. And it's, so I started doing Compline. I started praying Compline. And so, the book isn't about Compline per se. In other words, it's not like, you should pray Compline. Here's why. Here's what Compline is. But it takes one prayer out of Compline, that it's, I'll just say it. I mean, it's the keep watch, dear Lord, with those who work or watch or weep this night, and give your angels charge over those who sleep. Tend the sick, Lord Christ, give rest to the weary, bless the dying, soothe the suffering, pity the afflicted, shield the joyous, all for your love's sake. Amen. And so each chapter in the book is a meditation on each phrase of that prayer. And I use the prayer as a way to enter into questions about theodicy, like why, how can God be all good and all powerful and bad things like regularly happen in the world, but also about vulnerability. Why does God allow us to continue to be vulnerable? How do we meet God in our vulnerability? How do we deal with living in a world where we are so prone to harm and wounding? So the book is wrestling with that, and in the context of darkness and light, where do we see God's light in the darkness? Where does God meet us in the darkness? And then finally, sort of the whole culmination of the book is in the love of God. Like, where is the love of God in the dark? Mm. And how do we continue to pray to a God that we hope and need to love us when things are dark and we're not sure and we're full of doubt? So that's what the book is about. So it's about my own struggle with where God is in the midst of loss and woundedness and fear of the future, and how do we keep praying when faith feels hard and distant, and when we can't settle for sort of trite answers? Mm-hmm. How do we continue in the faith? Mm. So, I guess it kind of gets back to this idea of rootedness that sort of has kept coming up in this podcast. Yeah.
What is your past? First of all, that's beautiful. And I love that it's rooted in your own story. I mean, very much like your first book, it's embodied. It's embodied, not to promote my own book, embodied. But it's embodied. That's not what I meant. It's embodied theology. It's a lived theology. It's not just speaking from a distance. And I think that's what makes it so powerful, like your first book. What is your pastoral response to theodicy? I mean, somebody comes to you, huge tragedy. Where is God in this? Like, how do you, and you know, I know you and I both know the theological options here, whatever, but like pastorally, how do
right.
you, How do you respond?
Well, the first thing I would do is give them my book. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. But it is funny because it's like, you know, I started this book. I've told this story other places. So, but if I didn't sit down to write this book, I tried to write another book about theology. And every time I tried to write that book, this is the question that I couldn't get around. And so it was like, once this idea came to me to write about Knight and Compline in this book, it was like this cat that just kept coming back to my house. I couldn't get rid of it. And so, I felt like I just had to write this book. Every other question that I was asking was a distraction from the actual thing I was dealing with, which is I don't know if I trust God. So to some extent, I mean, I had to write 70,000 words and then edit it down to 50,000. Don't worry, the book's not 70,000 words, but I had to write that many and edit it over a year and a half before I could even really begin to answer that question. So I wouldn't actually give someone who's hurting my book, but I do think this is my answer. This is the best I got right now, is this book. And I in general will say, for real, by the book, but in general, like, I think when people bring this question, this is a real question. Like part of the motivation for this book was, Barna did a study of younger folks who, were non-believers that had left the faith or were not part of a faith. And their number one or in the top reasons for them not believing in the Christian faith, it was, it's hard for them to buy that a good God could allow bad things to happen in the world. And it was actually cited, it was one third of all folks who responded said that was their reason for not believing. And that's higher percentage with Gen Z and millennials than they've ever seen before. So it seems like this is becoming more of a question, which is interesting, right? In a world where we have, you know, more vaccines and we're safer and we have, you know, anti-lock breaks, this has actually become more of a question, like a bigger question for younger folks. But I'll say, I think, so it's never a purely intellectual question, right? And I say this in the book is that I think there are sophisticated philosophical answers to this, and those are very helpful, very helpful.
But they're incomplete. They're insufficient in and of themselves, I would say.
Right. Yeah. Because at the end of the day, what I say in the book is that this is a cry for things to be made right. I think at the end of the day, it's our soul's longing that we don't just want answers. We want action from a God that sets things right, that brings justice, that heals diseases, that binds wounds. We want the restoration of the world. We want things to be made better. And I think that that longing is right to have. And I think that we, to the extent that we try to save God's reputation by giving pat answers or by saying it's not that bad or look at the bright side, we're actually extinguishing or trying to snuff out a longing for things to be made right in the world that is from God and that is right. So I think that we have to be honest about the brokenness in the world and about how we need God to come and to set, to bind wounds, to mend what needs mending. So I'm saying, I think it's more of a, almost a primordial cry for things to be made right that we all as humans share. that this question comes out of. And I just want to affirm that, like, that is the right response to darkness. Like, that is a true response to the brokenness of the world. Now, I don't think it just ends there, because I think God has responded to that cry, not perfectly. I mean, I make, and that's not the right word, not with like an easy answer or a complete answer. I mean, God has responded perfectly because he is God, but I mean, I don't think that there, I think at the end of the day, enduring the brokenness in the world, the problem of evil it's enduring. Mm-hmm. It's enduring a mystery. Mm-hmm. And so I talk a lot in the book about enduring a mystery, that phrase and what that means and how we do that. But the reason I think it's about enduring a mystery as opposed to finding an answer is I don't think that this can be answered until God himself sets things right. I think that we're longing for a culmination of things that we will not fully be satisfied until we see God set things right. I mean, in some sense, the entire Christian story, creation, fall, redemption, consummation, is an answer, if there is any answer, to the problem of evil. The story of Jesus is the answer. Mm. Now, that said, we have to sort of walk through that day by day. We're living out that story. And so I think that even in our frustration with God, there's a hope, there's a longing that this isn't it. This isn't the evil, that darkness doesn't have the last word, that there is something else. There's something to set things right. There's something to, you know, make things the way we long for, make, as Bilbo Baggins said, I think, like, make all the sad things come untrue. And so I think the whole story is a response to that. But that we won't be satisfied until, like, here's what I'm saying. The whole story is a response to this. Mm-hmm. But there's no chapter and verse that you can give someone in scripture that tells people why their mother has cancer.
Right.
Or why they had a horrible childhood, or why coronavirus exists, right? The church has known that. This is not a surprise to thousands of years of Christians. And they've let that cord in scripture go unresolved. It's this tension. It's this unresolved cord in music. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, I think it is because only God himself can sound the note that will resolve that chord. And so we are still walking through creation, fall, redemption, consummation, right? Mm-hmm. And so how do we endure that? How do we endure the longing? And that's a lot of what my book is about. How do we continue in faith when there's not like a pat little answer that's going to put a little bow on this. It's just, that's not going to happen. So then why stay in? Why don't we leave it? So that's what my book's about.
Thank you for that. Anecdotally, I would affirm that Barna study. I think that the question of the, you know, problem of evil, theodicy, whatever you want to call it, which is related to the doctrine of hell and suffering and evil in the world and everything. I think there is a need for the church to have a better response to those questions, which isn't a pat answer. I love the way you're not giving up answer in a sense. Like, here's the right, you know, it's entering into the story. It's acknowledging the mystery. It's embracing God, with some level of doubt and difficulty and not plastering over that. I mean, to be honest, to be vulnerable with you, I mean, you're a pastor, so maybe you can help me out here. I have a growing difficulty with two things in the Christian narrative. Number one are the pervasive number of passages that seem to give promises of protection. God will not let your foot slip if you're faithful. I mean, the Psalms are filled with them. People are so, they love the Psalms. I have a hard time with so many Psalms, not just the imprecatory ones. Psalm 139, you know, dash my enemies' babies up against the rocks and crush their faces on this, you know, like that. That's problematic, as C.S. Lewis pointed out, and many others. But the promises of protection drive me crazy.
Like Psalm 91, that's all about, you know, the pestilence will not come to your dwelling. It's like, well, how do we say that? How do we say that right now?
You can't. I can't. And all I can say as a theologian is, well, that's not really a promise. It's a cry. But it, sure, the word will not come to your... It certainly sounds like I can't quote that without giving all kinds of caveats and explanations, because people are like, well, it sure as hell came to my door. Where, you know, and like, yeah. I don't know what to say. I have the same kind of struggle. And the only answer I can come up with is a doctrine that I don't think is the best representation of scripture. And that's ultimate reconciliation. And I'm going to get some emails for this. I'm an annihilationist. I'm not an annihilationist. I'm a interpreter of scripture who has recognized the pervasive evidence for annihilation in the Bible. You and I might be in disagreement on that, but even that doesn't satisfy. The only theological answer I think that actually satisfies my soul is that in the end, God truly will reconcile and redeem and bring beauty out of all the evil and chaos in the world, which any kind of doctrine of irreversible punishment doesn't do. I don't know what to do with the 15-year-old teenage girl in Saudi Arabia who happened to be born into a Muslim family who meets a missionary on the streets and rejects the gospel because she doesn't even know what that is, and then gets hit by a truck. And I don't have a soul satisfying answer that good will come out of that unless in the end she will live forever with her creator. But I don't see that taught as compelling in scripture as other doctrines of the end time. So can you pastor me through my struggles here?
You're going to get me in trouble, Preston. Okay. We only have like 5 more minutes because I have to go get my son.
To be continued.
So in like 5 minutes, let me wade into this huge thing. I mean, I will say, here's what we can affirm. I think Jesus is a judge. He's a judge of hearts, and he judges evil. He judges evil in us. And that's, we can affirm that. And we can affirm that he wishes none to perish.
Yeah.
I think, well, I'll just be honest. I mean, I think my concept of hell, like to some extent, actually, I'll say this. The only time I say this in the book, but I tend to not connect with God as a judge. That's a hard concept for me. And I'm much more like kind of like the hippie Jesus, like the chill Jesus. Like
Austin Jesus. But,
yeah, totally. But, but I encountered this really horrific situation overseas where children were being essentially held captive through the adoption system. They were folks that wanted to adopt them, and they were taking more and more money from them, but never processing the papers to get these kids ready for adoption. And so they were just being, it was a they were using kids as bait. They were using kids to make money. And it was evil. It's awful. It's exploiting the weak. And nothing was being done about it. And nothing has been done about it because the authorities were being bribed. In that situation, I realized no one is coming for these children. There's nothing to do. And my only hope was that, like, God saw and God would come as a judge, like that God would judge mm-hmm. and care for the weak. Now, so I think because I affirm kind of the creeds, mm-hmm. like I have to believe that there is so that we can distance ourselves to God. I mean, I guess I'm talking about something about like hell, but when people hear, I'm like hesitant to use that word because people automatically think eternal conscious torment and a guy with, like, right. you know, a pitchfork and fire, which is not at all what I mean.
Right.
I mean that it's possible for us to remove ourselves from the goodness of God, that God himself is heaven, communion with God, unity with God is heaven, and that that's not compulsory or mandatory, that God, that we can reject that and move away from that. And so we make our own hell. So we diminish ourselves, right, from moving away from the source of life. Now, that said, I think that, like, if there's a door in hell, it's only locked from the inside, right?
Yeah.
That there is a sense that anyone who longs for God and to know God, that will not be thwarted, even if you're a 14-year-old Muslim girl, right? That, and so I think Jesus is the source of all salvation, period.
Right.
So I'm absolutely fine with saying there is judgment. I'm absolutely fine with saying we can cut ourselves off from the grace of God, or we can reject the grace of God. We don't, it's not, God's a gentleman. He doesn't, like, force himself on us. But I will never say this individual is saved and this individual is damned. Like, I just think that's in the wild mystery of God. I will not say that.
Yeah.
What does it mean that Jesus makes all things new?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
What does that mean? And that absolutely is our hope. I mean, I think you're right that at the end, you know, I saw someone talking about, like, basically, I don't believe in God because it was on Twitter because of this, like, horrible, you know, sad video of a woman with dementia. And I thought, well, we have dementia either way, God right. or no God. Yeah. Like, there's horror in the world. What I have in Jesus is hope that the chaos and the destruction that is dementia. I don't mean people with dementia. I mean dementia itself, the disease that is, will be judged and will be subdued and will be put to death under the power of Jesus. Mm-hmm. So what does it mean that Jesus makes all things new? Does that open itself to a kind of annihilationism? I certainly think that it might. Is being annihilated part of judgment? Like, it could be that when we diminish ourselves by turning away from the grace of God, we get more and more and more diminished, so that we no longer exist. The question is, though, and it's a valid question, is there something truly eternal about the human soul that it mm-hmm. continues, that it goes to greater and greater diminishment but never snuffs out, because the possibility of redemption is always there. And just because the human soul is eternal. Now, all of that, I have no idea. Like, all of that is shrouded in mystery, and there's not scriptural, there's not, like, utter scriptural clarity. Right. So I didn't mean to talk about annihilationism here, but like, I'm open to that sort of idea, with as long as we can stand and say that Jesus comes to judge the living and the dead, because I think that's true. I mean, I affirm that that's true.
Right. Yeah. No. Sorry to open up a huge can. Right. You gotta go.
Jesus also makes all things new.
Yeah.
And I think what you're saying is that at the end of the day, that's all the hope we got. And I think that's true. I mean, anything writing this book has made me come down on, if Christ is not risen from the dead, we really, really ought to be pitied above all men. Like, all my eggs are in that basket now. Like, if that's not true, then really there is almost no point to doing anything other than making your life as comfortable as possible while you're here.
Right? No, that's it. That's it. No, I should have given this caveat when I talked about my, you know, some problems I have with scripture or the Christian narrative. I'm very okay having problems with their Christian narrative, because I do believe that it is the best story that you can live. That doesn't mean I have to understand or even like every aspect of the story. Of all the alternatives, it is by far the best story. And my trust is in a God of grace, a God of judgment, that he's going to work it out perfectly. And I 100% have trust that. Whether or not I understand the particulars, that's another issue. And there's some particulars that seem to be revealed in scripture. I'm like, I don't resonate with that. But what's my other option? The problem of evil isn't a uniquely Christian problem. It's a human problem, you know? So I'm fine having disruption within the story that I don't quite resonate with as much as other aspects of the story. It is the best story that we can live, in my humble opinion.
And I also think, but there has to be room, what you're talking about, and my book goes into this, is lament. I mean, if you're going to be a Christian, we just have to learn lament. And lament is not just like I'm sad, although that's part of it. It's holding God to God's own promises. It's saying, like, where are you? How long, oh Lord?
Yeah.
And I think we can come to God with really sharp words and be like, this doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. Where are you? What are you doing? Mm-hmm. And I think scripture is really raw about struggles and doubts and darkness is my only friend, right? In Psalm 88. Like, what an intense way to end. And that's part of it, right? Yeah. And so I think that the kind of stuff you're talking to about, like, struggling with God's own promises. So much of the Christian life is looking at the promises of God, looking at the reality of our life and saying, how can this be true? Because you promised this, because you promised Psalm 91, like, how can coronavirus be true? How can this be true? Mm-hmm. And that's lament. That's saying, God, I am holding you to your own promises. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the ways we endure the mystery of theodicy is by leaving room for grief around that and leaving room for lament around that. We don't stop there. And then I go on in the book, but that's part of it. Mm-hmm. And if we miss that step, then I think we're going to inevitably have a thinner, like a less honest faith. Like, it's going to be just like, we're going to result in sort of saccharine answers because we can't wrestle with the real things that you're bringing up that scripture brings up. Like, I think your average Christian church service in America, we're taught to be less honest with God than the scriptures themselves are. So in the very most common psalm, more common than the Psalm 91 promises of things working out, is lament. It's the most, it's 40% of all psalms are lament. And so I think that posture of response, what you are feeling and talking about is lament. Mm-hmm. I think that is absolutely a Christian practice. Yeah. And you're not going to, I'm not saying you particular, but we are not going to be able to endure in this faith, in our faith, if we don't take it up and learn it.
Tish, that's a great way to wrap up what I think is a super interesting conversation. Tish, you have a website, tishharrisonwarren.com, two books, which I've already talked about, and it's in the show notes. So you got to run. Your kids are probably pounding at the door.
Yeah, my son.
Thanks so much for being on the show again. I really appreciate your work, your ministry, and I wish there were 100 more Tish Harrison Warrens out there, but well,
thanks.
We only have one.
I feel like we'd be friends. I wish we lived closer.
I know, right?
Oh, well.
Yeah. Well, let's, I'll have you on again when you write another book.
Okay,
no, I'm not going to wait till you write a book.
In 8 years.
All right, take care.